This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody. Oh man, we got a big episode today. Happy birthday to me. Well, it's not my birthday, but it's a big celebration regardless. Episode number 100. And could there be a more fitting guest? Not only are they one of the biggest bands in the punk hardcore scene, not only are they some of the best people in the scene, but also a great friend of mine and the artist of the show's theme song, at least for now, State of the Union. A lot of people ask what the theme song of the show is. It is Rise Against. It is State of the Union. And that is our guest today. Tim McElrath is here. And I got to say, this is one of my favorite episodes I've done. And I think it's because we have so much to talk about. Tim and I go way back, all the way back to 2003, when Rise Against took Silverstein out on one of our first tours. And it is so awesome to see the success Rise Against has had while continuing to put out great music and still spread their message. Before we get into that, so many people I have to thank for this being episode 100. It's incredible. When I started this thing, I didn't even know if it was going to last 10 episodes, let alone 100. So this is incredible. I got to thank Mike Mowry and Matt Carter over at Jabberjaw, Nick Bunda for giving me my start, Caleb Shomo for being my guinea pig, and all the guests I've had. Amazing guests, amazing people. I've made so many friends. If any of you are listening to this, thank you so much for taking the time, being a part of this show, helping it grow. And of course, all the listeners from all over the world, keep the emails coming. Keep the contact on social media up. I love hearing from you guys. Email address, of course, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I read everything I get sent. I'm pretty bad at responding. That's something I'm working on. You know, sometimes people have a New Year's resolution. I'm trying to have like an episode 101, you know, new 100 episode resolution, if that makes any sense. So I'm going to be posting them. I think it's a good thing. For example, our Facebook page, kind of in shambles right now. I'm looking at getting that worked on. But hey, go like us anyways. And of course, some huge plans, some huge guests, and some really cool special events coming up right now for when we've hit triple digits. Last but not least, I want to thank each and every member of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. You are single-handedly the reason I've been able to get this thing to 100 episodes. The support you've shown me, the love, and of course, you guys kicking in $6, $9, $25, $75, $100 a month. That stuff really does help me keep the show going. I have so much love, so much respect. This show really is for you guys. If you want to support the show, that's the best way. Join the All Access Club. Check it out. The link is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. For as little as $6 a month, it gets you in. You can have access to our beautiful community on the Facebook group, Q&As with me every month, and of course, all kinds of bonus content. So just check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. As I record this, I'm packing my bags. I'm heading down south to the Caribbean for a very, very relaxing vacation. I believe I deserve it. 100 episodes, what do you think? Every 100 episodes, I get a vacation? But not to worry, I will be back next week with a special Halloween episode. So make sure you're subscribed. And of course, let me know what you thought about this episode. And you know what? We got 99 old episodes to check out as well. So go back, check them out. If you like the show, please go write a review on iTunes, preferably 5 stars. That's another thing that really helps the show. All right, well, let's get into it. Episode 100, an eye-opening and very informative conversation with my friend, Tim of Rise Against.
Don't hold me up. Now I can stand my own ground. I don't need your help. Now you won't let me down. Now I can stand my own ground. I don't need your help. Now you won't let me down. Being told.
Tim, what's up, man?
How you doing?
Dude, I'm pretty good. How are you?
How's your... You just flew to Germany?
Yeah, I just flew from Germany. And, I mean, you know how that's... It's like that annoying amount of time where, like, it's not quite a full night's sleep.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and you just kind of lose 6 hours out of your life, and you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
Well, on top of that, we got here, and our driver, like, I guess he, like, slept in or something.
Oh, awesome.
And, yeah, and we had to wait. Well, he said it was going to be three and a half hours, and it ended up being 5 hours. So we sat in the airport for 5 hours with our gear. So I'm sorry I'm a little late calling you. I'm calling you from, like, one of those classic German, very punk rock, like, alleys. Lots of spray paint. I think if some dogs start barking, you'll know what that is. So
that's really funny. Well, it sounds good. You got a good connection, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think this is working. I've got a little bit of a different setup, but dude, first of all, congratulations to me. This is episode number 100.
Oh, badass! I feel honored.
You know what? It is kind of an honor, and to just to speak with you and one of my oldest friends, you know, in music, really. To be honest with you, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I chose Rise Against as the theme song music for the show. So it's been played 100 times, you know.
I like it.
The State of the Union, which is a sick intro, you know, it really
awesome.
Is.
Awesome. So hopefully you're not sick of it yet.
Well, I want to talk to you later about that. Because I'm thinking maybe it's time to change the music.
All right.
But I'm going to give you some time to think about it because I don't want to put it right on you right now. But I would love for you maybe to pick the new song.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Maybe every 100 episodes I switch the music. I don't know. Maybe we keep... State of the Union seems to be working. Maybe we keep it. I don't know.
All right. Well, you know, change is good. So, but you're asking me to change it to a non-Rise Against song. We got to pick a different band.
Well, I don't know. No, it could be another Rise Against song. I appreciate you keeping it in the family. If you got another, like, sick part that you think would work, maybe another band. I don't know, man. I'm totally open to ideas.
Right. I'll have to mull it over.
It was funny when I first started the podcast, and I didn't really know anything about how podcasts worked, and the producer, you know, that was working on it said, well, you better pick a song. And the first song that came to mind that I thought would be cool was Too Drunk to Fuck. But just I thought that was like a cool kind of theme song.
Totally.
And then after a while, I was like, nah, I got to go with something a little more current. And actually, you know, I thought of, well, who are some people in the scene, you know, that I really respect, you know, as musicians, as a band, as what they're trying to say. And to me, I mean, you guys are definitely at the top of the list.
Oh, thank you, man. We appreciate that.
I'm sucking up to you way too hard already, aren't I?
No, I can sit here all day and listen to this.
Well, we've had a lot of great conversations over the years, and some of them stem from one of the first tours Silverstein ever went on, like where there was like a headliner, you know,
because
I know you played in a million bands, and I want to get to as many of them as we can, because I love that shit. You know, in the Chicago days, and you'd go on tour, and it would be like, well, we don't want to play last today. Like, you know, you're in this kind of package, and everyone's sort of rotating, headlining. But your tour that you brought us on back in 2003 was literally the first time we'd ever been on a tour. It's like, okay, this is the clear headliner, you know, and you kind of brought us out. And it was actually, I don't know if you knew that, but that short run up in Canada and a few U.S. states was actually the first tour, real tour we ever had.
I feel like I didn't realize that. It was also, I want to say, it may have been like our first proper headline tour of Canada, or at least that part of Canada that we did.
It's very possible, yeah.
Yeah, because we were one of those bands that kind of, I feel like we stunted our growth for so long. Like, we were even past the point where we were able to headline, we would pass up those opportunities and just take every support slot we could get, you know, take every opening slot we could get. And we, I don't know, it's hard to, I'm sure you experience this too. It's hard to, like, imagine yourself as a headliner after you've opened so many shows. It's kind of like, it seems like this daunting, overwhelming responsibility where it's like, well, we couldn't possibly, you know, be responsible for the draw, you know, like, we need to always be opening or supporting at least. And so we put that off, and we took so many opening slots and support slots for so many years. But now I look back and I think that I attribute a lot of what we have to that. It's like putting ourselves in front of a lot of people.
Well, one of the first shows, actually the first show I ever saw you guys play was in Buffalo, New York, and I believe it was Strung Out was headlining.
Oh, you were at that show.
I was at that show. And that was actually a really interesting show. I'll get to that in a second. But it was, I remember it was Strung Out. And of course, like, to go back to what you were saying, like Strung Out, that's a band, like, that's they have so many albums and they've been, like, a staple in punk rock forever. Like, of course, Strung Out can headline a show.
Absolutely.
But when you're on, like, one record, maybe two records, you know, that's definitely daunting to be like, well, how do we put on a show? Like, do we know how to play all of our songs? Are they all going to work in a flow? Like, what the hell do I say to the crowd? You know, it is very daunting as a new band.
There's also, like, there's a shift in expectation that I realized after we started headlining, too. Because, like, I really enjoyed being Rise Against and being the opening band that much of the audience had not heard of before. And so you walk onto stage and you are underestimated. You know what I mean? You walk onto stage and people are prepared to be disappointed in a way. You know what I mean? Because they're like, we didn't come here to see you. We came here to see the band after you, you know? And so now we have to put up with you. And so when you actually win that crowd over, it's like, wow, that feels really good. Like, they weren't expecting us to be good and they were impressed and this is awesome. And then when you start headlining, there's a shift in expectations where it's like, we expect you to be good. You know, we won't be surprised when you are. You need to be. We came here to see you. And so it's almost like, oh man, this is like, people have heard of us and they came here to see us. They paid money to see you play. And it's all of a sudden like a whole different kind of responsibility. You're no longer kind of like the surprise opener.
It's true. It's true. And that's, I love that you bring that up too. Like, I remember the early days of us, you know, opening tours and stuff, and they'd be like, all right, you guys, I'm sorry, you guys are going to have to only play like 25 minutes. We'd be like, great. We'll play five songs, we'll play our best five songs, and we'll get the hell out of there. And people will be like, huh, remember that band? Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
You don't wear out your welcome. You just kind of give people what they want, and you get the hell out of their way, and then they enjoy the rest of the show. But they remember, oh yeah, that band was pretty cool. Maybe I'll check them out. And there's nothing worse than playing. Like, sometimes now we get a direct support slot, and it's like they want to put us on for like almost an hour or something. And it's like, man, that's just too long to listen to music you don't know.
Right. Yes, that's a good point too. Yeah. Especially, and if you're a support slot too, it's kind of like, if you're a support slot, that's usually when a band asks you to be a support slot and play that long, it's kind of like, maybe we should be talking about co-headlining here. You
right.
know what I mean?
If this is what you think
that we should be doing every night, then maybe this is not like necessarily like a headliner / support kind of tour.
You're totally right. I don't know if we've ever been actually asked to play for an hour on like as direct support. But even 45 is kind of long, you know?
Yeah, we've been on tours where I felt like it was like, wait, you know, I'm happy to do this for an hour, but like, you know, this is really, we're talking about a co-headline thing, you know, like we're just like supporting you, like this. And but yeah, being underestimated is you know, it's a cool thing, you know, when you kind of walk out and take people by surprise, and that shifts when you start headlining your own shows.
No, absolutely. Well, back to that show in Buffalo, and I don't even know what year that was.
So you came to the strangest show of that whole tour.
Well, I'll tell you from my perspective, and this is kind of, I'll try to give them the slow roll here because I love the reveal. So at the time, you know, Strung Out, I remember it was Strung Out and Poison the Well was playing too, and Poison the Well was like almost as big as Strung Out the time. So it was kind of this like,
absolutely.
And you guys were like a heavier band, so it was like a kind of a cool punk rock and hardcore show. And I think it was Rufio was the other band too.
Yes, absolutely,
So, I'm waiting in line with my friend, and at the time, Simple Plan was like just starting to get big, and it was a little bit of a like an eye roll thing, like the I'm just a kid, like it was sort of like really sugary. It was on Much Music, you know, in Canada, like the MTV of Canada. It was really like kind of getting like rammed down everyone's throat, and I don't want to say like it was hated, but it was very much like, okay, this is like mall punk, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I'll be honest, I always thought they were a pretty great band and pretty good songwriter. So I remember standing outside in line, and I was like, oh, that's really weird that they're playing Simple Plan CD like during changeover for these bands. Like, you know, you'd think they'd play something a little more like heavy or like punk rock or something, you know what I mean? Aggressive. And I walk in and no, that's not the CD. That's them playing, opening the show, and they just jumped on. So right. Weird.
Yeah, it was so weird. That day started too, I'll tell you even more. Prior to that tour, we hired a new guitar player. So we lost a guitar player before, and we hired our friend Todd Money, who was my roommate and co-guitar player in some other bands we played in, like The Killing Tree, together. And he agreed to do the tour, but he was finishing college at the time. You know, he was about to graduate from DePaul University in Chicago with like a computer science degree. So he's on his fourth year. It's like he doesn't want to just walk out his last semester. And he was like, if you guys promise me I can be in Chicago for the finals, my teacher will agree to like let me go on this tour.
Okay.
Because I'm doing pretty good, but I got to be in Chicago for the finals. And we're like, okay. So we figured out the Strung Out tour, and we figured out that there was a day off right before the Buffalo, New York show that Todd could do his finals. This was also a point where like none of us could barely afford our rent, much less like last minute flights to get places, you know?
Yeah.
And so like he got to Chicago on the day off. We carried on to Buffalo, New York to be there. And then a friend of ours drove him after he did his finals. A friend of ours drove him from Chicago all the way to Buffalo, New York, to make it in time for that show at that theater, in Buffalo. So we get there, we're just happy to see him, and he did his finals, and it's like, all right, you just finished college and you're playing our band, like everything worked out. And same thing, like same experience as you. Like, I was not privy to the fact that a band was jumping on the bill that day. I don't think anybody was. It was all kind of a weird mystery. I mean, to be honest, to this day, I never really even bothered Strung Out to find out what the hell happened, because we've been doing that tour for weeks, and it was just Rufio opening, Rise Against playing second, Poison the Well supporting, Strung Out headlining, and all of a sudden there's a band playing, and I had never heard of Simple Plan before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know who they were.
I guess because they were getting big in Canada. That's why I knew, yeah.
Yeah, all I knew is that Joe, who played in 88 Fingers Louie, was like, why is the kid from Reset here?
And, exactly.
Because he knew those guys from that band, and I'm thinking, I don't know either. And all of a sudden there's a band opening up, but then there was tons of like screaming kids freaking out over it too.
Oh, so I don't remember that. I think I walked in right as they were finishing, but that's okay. That's such a weird dynamic. Wow.
Yes, it was definitely like a lot of kids who had come in to the show to see Simple Plan, and we were just largely unaware of the phenomenon that was Simple Plan. And so the whole thing was like that was our introduction to that whole world. And then I think they just kind of took off, and then all of a sudden our tour our show just continued from there on out.
Just continued. Yeah, you just went on about your tour.
Yeah, I remember I don't know what that was, but it just happened.
I think I remember you having some kind of guitar problems that day too.
Absolutely. I love that you remember it, and I hate that you remember that too.
Right.
It was like, yeah, I remember it was Todd actually, who was our guitar player, and I think his head went out or something. He had had such a long day anyway. He just his college finals, and he drove from Chicago. I felt so bad for him. It really wasn't his fault. It's just shitty equipment, and it went out. But I remember laughing about it because our best friend Jeff, who played bass in The Killing Tree, who's the guy who drove him from Chicago to Buffalo that day. Jeff was on the side of the stage smoking a cigarette, and as Todd's shit was just falling apart, Jeff was just sitting there looking at him and not helping him at all. And I remember thinking, like, what the hell, dude? What are you doing? Like, we're failing here. It's all falling apart in front of Buffalo, New York. Please help us get this shit together.
Yeah, that's funny. I almost want to say I remember that specifically, too. You know, it's always like that awkward moment when you're at a show and like you see something go wrong and like, you know how a guitar rig works more or less,
right?
Or how a cymbal stand, you know, you can put it back up and like when it falls down and like, you know, it's like, or when you're watching a band and like someone like throws something on stage and the tech is just kind of like looking off into space and you're like,
right,
the bass player's about to trip on that shoe, dude. Like, go get out there, get it.
Well, and especially, I'm sure you know too, like in your early days as a band, like, you know, you can't afford quality equipment, you know?
No.
You've got a bunch of, like, hand-me-down stuff, you know, that was barely working when it was in your rehearsal space or your basement. And then you start taking it on tour and exposing it to, like, everything from, like, below zero freezing temperatures to, like, extremely hot, like, desert temperatures of Arizona. And it's getting bumped around in your trailer. And you have this Marshall head that just, like, just getting tossed around. So you end up going to play these shows, and it's like your head that you spent your last $1,000 on is crap it out because it's getting beat up and you can't afford a proper road case for it, you know?
I know.
So you have all those kind of, the fact that shows like that happen, you know, is somewhat of a miracle, you know, if they ever do.
Well, I'm not endorsed by Marshall or anything, but I will tell this quick story.
Yeah.
We were driving one time in Michigan, middle of the winter, and we hit some black ice and we spun out. It wasn't too serious. We were going pretty slowly. I was driving, actually. And we spun out and we kind of went into the, not into the ditch really, but kind of into the, like, there was no guardrail. Just, I don't know what you call it. Just on this kind of in the middle. So the inertia from, I guess, the van spinning around, we had barn doors on our trailer and our gear just went all over the road, all over the highway.
Oh.
And this is really early in our career, so we couldn't afford road cases or anything.
Right.
And we had, I had this, it was actually my head that I let our guitar player Neil borrow, a JCM 900. And this Marshall JCM 900 rolled out into the snow onto the highway. We had to run out and go pick it up so like a truck didn't run over it.
Right.
It was full, like the thing was packed full of snow. Like it didn't have that you know, that like gold metal grate on the back of a Marshall.
Yeah.
It didn't have that. So all the snow was literally just packed in there. So we kind of just like used our hands to get the snow out of the amp, whatever.
Right.
We're all, you know, we were pretty shooken up. We went home. We went to practice. We were like, well, that amp's fucked. Turn it on. Never sounded better.
You're kidding me.
It was fine.
It's just so random how that shit works, right?
I know.
I have no clue. Have you ever heard our mutual friend Juan Cuellar? Have you ever heard
Juan? I love Juan.
Have you heard his black ice story?
No.
Okay. I'm going to try to tell as best as I can. I'll keep it short. We're on our first European tour of with Sick of It All. And so we were out there with them. I'm in line and catering somewhere like Belgium maybe with Juan. I'm right behind Juan. He's in front of me in food. He's chatting with the catering lady. Turns out she's American, I think, you know. And they're having a conversation. And he's asking her about what it's like to live here, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And she mentions, and I'm kind of just eavesdropping in the conversation, right? I'm not part of it. I'm still like,
right.
I'm still getting my salad together and Juan down the table, like on his main course, you know? And so I'm just eavesdropping. And she says something like, you know, it was one of the interesting adjustments was the black ice. And Juan has a crazy look on his face, like, what? And she's like, black ice, like just everywhere you go, black ice. I wasn't used to that. You know, driving around and black ice. I didn't know how to deal with that when I first moved here. And I'm hearing the conversation and I'm looking at Juan. He looks kind of confused, a little bit like, you know, quizzical slash like offended. And he goes, well, that's interesting. You know, I'm from Chicago and there's just a really diverse population of all kinds of people of all colors where I'm from. So I find it strange that you were that shocked by, and I'm listening. I'm like, and I finally walk in after watching this awkward, and I'm like, Juan, she's not saying black guys, she's saying black ice, and he's like,
that's so amazing.
I know, it's amazing the lost in translation kind of things that happen.
That's too funny. Yeah. Oh man, shout out to Juan. Is he still in Australia? God, I love that guy.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna see him in like February. I see him, you know, not often enough.
Well, back to what you're talking about, you know, what you're talking about this show where you're on a bill, you're like, you know, second of four, Strung Out's headlining, they're getting a little bit older, but they're still doing okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever have in your wildest dreams that Rise Against could go to where it's gone?
No, absolutely not. And to be honest, like, which I was just never very careerist about Rise Against at any point, you know.
Right.
I guess partially that came from, I think, being from Chicago, you know, you don't have a lot of like delusions of grandeur coming out of that town. You know, it's like, we're not LA. We're not LA. We're not New York. You know, we're not a coast band. I'd come out of like, I'd gone to a lot of different shows and was a part of a lot of different scenes in Chicago, from like metal and hardcore, everything from like vegan straight edge, you know, crazy earth crisis stuff to like, I loved like Cap and Jazz and all the bands like that were coming out of Chicago.
Yeah.
I loved Peg Boy. And so Rise Against kind of towed those lines in a lot of ways, you know, we didn't really fit into a lot of that stuff. And then as the band got momentum, we certainly, you know, gathered our own sort of humble following, but the bands that were really taking off around that time were bands like Poison the Well and Thrice and Thursday and Taking Back Sunday, Jimmy Oro, yeah. Like a lot of that stuff. And I never, those were all friends of mine and I loved those bands. I love those bands. I just thought like, but we're just kind of this scrappy punk band and that's not really, that's not for us. You know what I mean? Like, I can see why an AR guy would call Thursday or Thrice, but they're not going to call us, you know? And it was something that we watched our peers sort of, you know, pass us by. But honestly, it's not that I even really aspired to, because I didn't think of it as a reality. I didn't think I was hearing like what Rise Against was doing on the radio. So I didn't think there was really, a place for it. But being part of the Fat family, that was kind of, you know, this crazy accomplishment in and of itself.
Sure.
You know, the day Fat Mike called and said, I want to sign your band. You know, and he said that before we had even played a show yet. You know, we had a demo that we put together, and then we had a series of false starts, like where we lost members of the band before we even played a show. And so we had like a year of just kind of like these false starts. And so before we even played a show, Fat was like, I want you to be part of this family. And that was such an incredible thing for us, because it really would inform like who we toured with, like things like that Strung Out tour that you saw, that was like Strung Out taking us under their wing and being like a Fat band, you know, like, Sick of It All taking us to, Europe was, you know, Sick of It All was on Fat Records at the time.
Right.
You know, No Effects took us out on our first, Western Canadian tour, you know, so, we really felt like, holy crap, this is cool. And these were all bands that I grew up listening to. You know what I mean? Like, I had
totally.
the Fat Music for Fat People compilation was on heavy rotation in every single one of my friends' cars. You know what I mean? And so,
me too, man. It was
totally.
It was a phenomenon. It was a scene. And it also gave you guys a legitimacy that
yeah.
all these kind of older bands were taking you out. And you know, you were developing that fan base.
Totally, yeah. And I feel like when Rise Against started too, we were playing a lot of like hardcore shows in Chicago. And so I knew that the label we would decide to go with would definitely inform the way people saw our band, you know?
Totally.
And instead of just being like another hardcore band, like I think having the Fat label on our record, it sort of challenged the listener a little bit to see like, well, this band's a Fat band, but they don't necessarily sound like a Fat band if there is like a Fat sound, or at that time there kind of was, you know, and it didn't really just lump us into like this like hardcore band world either.
No.
And we were at the time, like we were giving demos to Nitro, Hopeless, Fat, and Victory Records, you know, and Victory was a Chicago label, you know what I mean? And so we were very much aware of Victory. They were having a lot of success with a lot of really cool bands like Snapcase and Refused. And Voice It's Fire, and the reputation around Victory nowadays hadn't yet bubbled to the surface.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it wasn't something that was a label that you were to be leery of. You know, I'm sure this is a whole separate podcast for you, Shane. But
oh, I've talked about Victory. Anyone that's listened to my podcast week by week knows how much I've talked about Victory on here. Tons of Victory bands, so this won't be news to anybody.
Right, totally. Well, I will say that we were trying to get signed to Victory, you know what I mean? Like we were thinking they would sign our band, and I thought, you know, I think there was a Chicago phenomenon too, where like big punk bands, and when I say big punk bands, like me bands like Idiot Fingers, Louie, like when they would break up, they would start another band. Those bands would inevitably be smaller than the band before it.
Right, of course.
And I was like, how does Rise Against overcome that? How do we sort of break that pattern where our band won't just be half the size of Idiot Fingers, Louie? And part of that to me was like maybe a label like Victory would legitimize this as more than just an ex Idiot Fingers Louie band.
But because then you go to the label that 88 was on originally and then left to go to Hopeless. Right.
And that's
so
true.
So it's almost like in some way, and it's not really, it was almost like a step back.
Yes, it was. Well, I will say that Victory passed on us.
Okay.
They didn't offer to sign our band.
Damn,
they gave
themselves
the demo.
Now, huh?
Well, they said no, which, you know, we can probably count our lucky stars for that, but like, and Fat was, I think Fat, Hopeless, and Nitro were all willing, but Fat was the most enthusiastic. And then we ended up on Fat, which was great, but I definitely thought we're never going to shed this ex-idiot Fingers Louie tag.
Yeah.
You know, like, I long for the day when that flyer finally just said, rise against, not just rise against three members of Idiot Fingers Louie. Not that I have anything against 88. It was just kind of like, we're our own band, you know?
Sure.
Like, and we deserve to be taken seriously.
It's funny, you know.
Fat might hurt that.
I had Dennis on the podcast just a few weeks ago.
Dennis, oh, nice.
Dennis from 88 Fingers Louie, and he actually said, well, he spoke very, very highly of you. Said you're a great dude, by the way.
We were talking about that time that 88 was starting, because I knew Dennis, and I was kind of like, hey, what am I getting myself into? You know, he was intimately familiar with Joe and Dan, and
yeah.
You know, he was 88 was a band that had their own internal drama, a band that, you know, broke up.
Yeah.
Like two or three times on the road, you know, with these epic breakup stories, you know, people punching each other, quitting in the middle of tours. And I was like, Dennis, am I walking into a trap here? What's going on?
Right.
He had some great advice for me too. And, you know, it was really cool. And he kind of gave the whole thing his blessing, which was exciting.
He did say though that I guess there were some 88 demos that he'd heard. And he was like, I don't know if I'm like really feeling this stuff, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And then he said, when he heard The Unraveling, he's like, five or six of those songs were like those demos with Tim singing on them. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And it's like, it's just funny. And he kind of says like, I mean, of course for him, obviously it's a completely different band. You're completely different people.
Right.
But he's always like, he was probably like kicking himself, jealous of you. And then you're starting this band being like, well, we're never going to be as big as 88. So it's it's a really funny thing where you have two singers like kind of jealous of each other.
Yeah. And Dennis is a much beloved character in Chicago.
Sure.
Was then and is now. He's this charismatic frontman, you know, like people... A lot of 88 at that time was probably, you know, our biggest punk band. They were the only band that was on a national label, like Fat or international label, only band that toured Europe. You know, that was like our legit band. You know, and so Dennis was, for all intents and purposes, a rock star in Chicago. And I'm sitting here thinking, I got to fill these shoes. Like, I got to walk in and I got to fill the shoes that people who are expecting to see Dennis Buckley on stage are going to get this like shaggy haired skinny kid screaming into a microphone, you know, about like politics and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know how this is going to go over, you know? And it's funny because, I never saw 88 Fingers Louie play a show before, you know? I never really even listened to 88. So like what I did hear, I knew Dennis had a great ear for melody and I love that stuff. And I love the songs who Joe was writing a majority of that stuff. And they were great songs. But like, I think that helped me because I took an approach to those songs that was my own and that wasn't necessarily influenced by anything that had come before. So
totally. Wow. I love how in depth we're getting here with some of this stuff. But
yeah, sorry. You know, probably like pre-band kind of like
we'll
stuff.
Get to all this other shit too. But you know, it's funny you bring up Fat Records, and I don't want to touch on this too much longer. But like, I'd say like 2001, yes, Fat Records, skate punk, that scene was still like pretty big. It was definitely big for me. I was about 20 at the time. But then I'd say 2003, when you guys put out your second record, it was starting to fade pretty fast. Like you know, you bring up Thursday and Thrice and Taking Back Sunday. Those bands were starting to be huge, and they were really taking over, you know, the whole emo movement and Dashboard Confessional and all that stuff. All the punk rock had kind of disappeared. And somehow you guys found a way to align yourself with a lot of bands that weren't, you know, I hate to say this because I like, it's my favorite genre, but like dying skate punk bands. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
A dying genre. You guys were able to break away. And,
right.
And I don't really know how you did it, but it was impressive. I don't even know if you really knew you were doing it.
I mean, I definitely knew that that there was something in our DNA that was different about what we were doing. Than everything on like Fat roster, you know, and then even just being like a little bit younger than a lot of those bands too. I knew I was from the same world as like Jeff and the Thursday Kids, you know what I mean? And like all the Thrice Kids, like that was my kind of age group. That was my kind of music. Like,
yeah.
I was in the Boys It's Fire crowds, you know what I mean? Like I was going to see Grade. I was going to see Snapcase, I was going to see Refuse. That was, you know, I was at, you know, a lot of those shows. And so I feel like that kind of, that helped kind of create the identity of Rise Against. And then going on tour and pushing to go on tour with bands like that, you know, so we weren't just, as much as we loved like all the Fat Records tours that we were a part of, we could also go and open up for Voices Fire. You know, we were also opening up for Thursday when they were getting bigger, you know, and playing shows with like the Movie Life. And so we were dancing between both scenes, you know. We were also opening up for Agnostic Front TSOL in the business.
Nice. You know what I mean? I'm wearing a TSOL hat right at the moment, actually. So
are you?
I am.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's funny because I'm here in Cleveland on a day off and Agnostic Front is playing tonight, so I think we're all going to go over there and check it out. That's one of my more vivid memories of like my whole career is being on stage at the Agora Ballroom opening for Agnostic Front and just being heckled for like 30 minutes straight by like Skins and, you know, Liberty Spike Punk Kids, you know, and like people just wanted to kill us because they came there to see TSOL and the business and Agnostic Front. But wow. I think actually when the business dropped off, the casualties picked up, you know, and we were first of four on this, by the way. We were first of four on that whole tour. And so like, I feel like we branched out. We were jumping from Mad Caddies tours to TSOL tours to Voices Fire tours, you know, so we were putting ourselves in front of a lot of different audiences and showing people that like, there's more sides to our band than maybe say like just the label on the back of our record. And I think we managed to convince people that we were our own thing.
No, absolutely not. It's awesome. And like,
and Fat was branching out too a little bit. They signed, yeah, you know, Anti-Flag, they signed Against Me, they signed Avail, they signed Sick of It all around that time, which maybe doesn't sound like a huge branch out nowadays, but at the time it was kind of like, holy shit, you know, Sick of It All's on Fat Records.
Sick of It All was a big thing. They're like, oh, they're going to sign hardcore bands now? Because they never really had any hardcore bands.
It was, there was a wave happening in the early 2000s like that. That was like, oh, this is they're signing like really cool bands, and the sound is changing.
Yeah.
And they're taking risks, and this feels a part of what we're doing.
So I got to ask you about this major label thing because, like you were saying, like I could never hear my voice on the radio, and to be honest, Tim, it was the biggest head scratcher for me too. We were on tour and you said, and the news came out or whatever, like, yep, we signed to DreamWorks and we're going to be on a major label. And I remember we were sitting in a diner, like in New Jersey, all of us. And I just remember like my face dropping and you seeing my face and going, it's probably even weirder for us than it is for you hearing it. But how did that call get, how did they find out about your band? How do they hear this music? How do they go, yeah, we want to sign this band? Like, it just seems so peculiar.
Yes, I agree. We were all taken by it. It was like I said, a lot of our friends were signing, but they were different kinds of bands. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly, yeah.
Like, it was like Thrice was going to be the next Deftones. Like, so was Poison in the Well. Like, Thursday and Take It Back Sunday, you know, like this made sense. Like, emo was blowing up. Yep. You know what I mean? And those guys
were no bands on Fat Records that did that. I mean, Against Me, yeah. I guess later on, but that was different too.
Totally. Yeah. And we put out Revolutions Per Minute on Fat. Fat was like super, as much they liked The Unraveling, but like when we delivered Revolutions Per Minute, they kind of like their whole tone changed. You know what I mean? They were like, this record's good. Like, I remember Fat Records being like, we have radio calling us to play your record, and we don't even have a radio department here at the label.
Wow.
You know, we don't even know how to, we don't have anyone. They actually hired somebody to start trying to field radio requests and try to like push it to radio because they were like, this is actually stuff that wants to get played on the radio. We were like, that's cool, you know, but we didn't think anything of it. And then this is also a time to bear in mind that like none of us have cell phones except for Joe. we don't have a manager, you know?
Yeah.
And if you want to get a hold of Rise Against, it's like pretty much Joe's cell phone number or like
riseagainstthehotmail.com.
Exactly. Something like, yeah, an email address. You know what I mean? Like we were just in a van looking at maps trying to get to the next show. That's what we were doing with our day. You know what I mean? So whatever was happening in LA or Hollywood, we were largely unaware of that. You know what I mean? And I would, I would actually credit our booking agent, Corey Christopher, who picked us up, you know, when we were playing for nobody and has been with us, and she's still our agent to this day. I think, and it's, as you tell the Rise Against story, by the way, our whole band has always been run by women. Our whole team has always been women. It's been like almost all exclusively female team, and we've had nothing but success with all of them. But Corey was booking Avenged Sevenfold, Against Me. She would go on to book like Gaslight Anthem. You know, she books Imagine Dragons nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
But she's just always had an ear for for good music. And when Avenged got signed, and I think somebody, oh, Yellow Card. She always booked Yellow Card too. Avenged got signed, Yellow Card got signed. Somebody else on her roster got signed, and finally someone in Hollywood said, this woman knows what she's talking about, and her roster is full of great bands. Wow. Who else is on her roster, you know? And that was the impression I got, was that like people wanted to know who Corey was booking, and then, well, Corey's like, well, I have this band Rise Against. And then next thing you know, it's getting passed around. And this is all happening without our knowledge, by the way. It's just kind of like we're just playing in punk squats in Italy with like Sick of It All while like our record's getting passed around these labels. And all of a sudden, before you know it, like we go to Europe for like 6 weeks and we come back and Joe's got all these voicemails from like A&R guys. And we're like, they want to come see us when we hop on the Warped Tour that summer. And we're just thinking, is this for real? Like, is this really a thing? And could we ever even leave Fat Records? And so all of that started happening. And we were it wasn't a totally foreign thing to us. We had just finished a tour with AFI. Right before that, it was the Art of Drowning tour. And so that was when there was a different A&R guy at every show for them, you know, kind of whining and dining them. We had just finished a tour with Poison's Fire right before they signed to Wind Up Records.
Yeah.
And so there was a different A&R guy at every night for them. And so all of a sudden that started happening to us. We would show up to these towns. And by the way, we're still in a van and trailer. We're still playing for a max of like 500 kids. And all of a sudden, A&R, like management, people just start, you know, calling us and saying, oh, I'd love to sit down with you guys. And so we just kind of agreed to do that. And then we didn't know what would come of it, but we agreed to start looking at all our options.
It's for me, it's interesting too, because back then I think everyone viewed you guys as this very, you know, forward-thinking political punk band, lyrically important, trying to get your message out. Even your name, Rise Against, you know, even your name in and of itself, which you probably don't think about anymore, is like, it's the theme of the band.
Right.
So, what was that like being like, oh my God, everyone is going to call us sellouts? Not only is like this label probably going to drop us because it's not going to work, because no one thinks this is going to work, but once we're on a major label, it's very hard to come crawling back to Fat Records and have all those people. You know, you're talking about, oh, you're probably having a great time in Italy playing with Sick of It All and the Squat and all this stuff. That's all going to go away if you decide to go down that road with DreamWorks. Was that a hard decision?
Yeah, especially, I talk about like bands that we were touring with at the time we were all signing. And one of the bands was Anti-Flag. So we were on a tour with, it was No More Black opening, Against Me playing second, Rise Against supporting, Anti-Flag headlining. And Anti-Flag were just signing to RCA. You know,
yeah.
And I was there on like Warped Tour when like Rick Rubin came out to like hang out with like Justin too and all those guys, you know. And like I'm watching A&R sort of come in and talk about Anti-Flag. I'm thinking, how are Anti-Flag going to sign? And then they signed. And then we went on tour with them. And then us and Against Me just gave them shit the whole tour. You know, just like we had so much fun. And like little did we know that like eventually every band on that tour would sign to a major label. You know, but like at the time, Rise Against and Against Me were both just like punker than thou, and we were just having a good time, just like kind of jabbing those guys a little bit. But when you saw them do it as well and you saw what the process was, it made us feel like, well, if we found a situation where we were comfortable, we could still do the things we want to do, then why wouldn't we do it? But I looked at it the same way you just said. And I remember having this conversation with some of the guys in Poison the Well during that Strung Out tour where I was like, man, are you guys really going to sign to Atlantic? Like, are you serious? You're going to leave like Trustkill and go to Atlantic? And one of the guys was like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put a record out on Atlantic and they're going to hate it and they're going to drop us. And then we're just going to go back to Trustkill and keep making records. And that's like That's our plan.
It's got to be Ryan that said that, because that sounds like that sounds like Ryan's voice right there.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to out him, but it was absolutely Ryan.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite people.
He is hilarious. Oh my god, he's the best. And so I was like, you know what? That sounds like a good plan. I guess, you know. Obviously, what you risk in that process is credibility, which isn't, to be honest, not something I thought about a lot as a 23-year-old kid. You know what I mean? I didn't think about credibility as like this, as this thing that you have or you don't have. I just thought, you know, we just play in this band and we are who we are, and I trust our instincts, you know. And I guess if credibility came along with that, I didn't realize how fleeting credibility can be, you know.
Sure.
And so I wasn't that forward thinking. So I probably didn't even consider how huge of a risk that was. But being like a music nerd and a fan of music, and so like I'm not a stranger to all the major label horror stories, you know what I mean? Like I'd read the Steve Albini's piece on major labels when I was like, you know, 18 years old, you know, like this was all like ingrained into our system, like major labels are bad. They will ruin your band. Everything bad will happen. And we kind of went into it with those sort of open eyes, and I guess that sort of that education of what a label is. And we still were like, let's do it. And that's when we found the guy Ron Handler at DreamWorks, and we really liked him. Ironically, I'm here in Cleveland. That's where we met. Ron Handler was here in Cleveland. He came to a Warped Tour. We played a side stage for about, you know, maybe 200 kids came over, This A&R guy came over and from DreamWorks, and he was like, "Hi, I'm Ron. I'm from DreamWorks. Do you guys want to go talk? I have a hotel room over here."
And room.
He's like, "You know, that." And we're like, we looked at him and we're just dripping in sweat. You know, the Warped Tour. We pushed our gear across like a parking lot back to our trailer.
Yeah, of course.
And we're just like looking at him and we're just like, "Does your hotel have a pool?" And he's like, "What?" We're like, "Does your hotel have a pool?" He goes, "Yeah, I think it has a pool." I'm like, "Let's go. We're going right now. Take us to your pool." And we all like got in like this pool at like some like Four Seasons hotel where we're just like, this guy's never going to sign us, but we're at least going to swim in this pool in the middle of this 100-degree day on Warped Tour and make him buy us dinner and whatever. But in the end, we really liked him. He kind of, not only did he assure us that like, obviously things like creative control would always be intact, but he loved Rise Against. He liked who we were. Yeah. You know what I mean? He wasn't, that was a good thing about our band, is that there was no false advertising. You know what I mean? If you want to find a band that you can mold and change and tweak their image and send them songs that somebody else wrote, there were probably lots of willing partners for that, you know, that kind of contract. We were a band who already knew who we were, you know, and we made no bones about this is who we are, but he liked that. You know, and if nothing else, I had great conversations with him about like, how can we make Rise Against more confrontational? Like, how can we ruffle feathers even more? Like, that's what he liked about our band. Right. So I thought, well, this is not the conversation I thought I'd be having with an A&R guy, but this is really cool. Well, and then we signed.
Talk to me about Swing Life Away then, because that on your major label debut, that's obviously the acoustic song. It's poppy. It's accessible. And that was pretty much, for a lot of people, that was the gateway song. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That sucked everybody in. Was that a song? Was that a song that you guys wanted to have? You wanted to have a song like that on your record? Was the label pushing for that, or was that just completely just no? This is a song we believe in.
That was such an anomaly.
It is an anomaly because you've done some stuff since like that, but before that you hadn't really.
Right, and to be honest, I wrote "Swing Life Away" right around the unraveling. But I wrote it with no agenda. I wrote it just as a song that just fell out of me in one day. And I remember writing it and I didn't know how to record it. And Neil Hennessy from the Lawrence Arms, some of my best friends, and he lived down the street from me and he had a four track. And so I called him up and I was like, "Can I come record this song on your four track?" He was like, "Absolutely." And I went down to his apartment and I recorded it with him. You know, and then I kind of left, and then that was it. And I remember playing it for the guys, and they were like, "Oh, like that's cool." And we were all kind of on the same page, like, "That's a cool song, but we're Rise Against."
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, I never tried to push that into the band. I never tried to like sell it. Like, we should do this. It was just kind of like, I kind of wrote this song. I'm kind of proud of it, you know, but it's not really a thing. You know, it's just something I wrote, and that was it. And then I actually recorded a version of it during Revolutions Per Minute with Bill Stevenson and Jason. And we did that only because Fearless Records approached us with their Punk Goes Acoustic compilation.
Oh, wow.
Yes, shortly after The Unraveling. And they said, we want to put you on our Punk Goes Acoustic compilation. And I'm looking at The Unraveling, I'm thinking, there's nothing on here that would sound good acoustic. Which I've been wrong, because now I do Ever-Changing and stuff like that.
Sure.
But at the time, it was like, there's nothing on here. Like, we don't have an acoustic song. We're not an acoustic band. And then somebody was like, Tim, what about that song you played us in the van that you recorded at Neil's? And I was like, oh yeah, like, maybe we could dust that off and like, give that to Fearless. And it'll just be like, an original song on the Fearless comp. And that's exactly what we did. And Bill and Jason recorded that for me during the Revolution Per Minute session. At no point did we ever consider putting it on Revolution Per Minute. And then from the Fearless comp coming out, it kind of took on a life of its own. And like,
I didn't even know that, actually. I didn't know it was on that comp.
Yeah, it was actually, it's actually a slightly different version if you like get nerdy about it.
Right, right, sure. Yeah.
It's missing like the bridge in the middle, like an instrumental bridge, because it was kind of like, I always called it more of like a ditty. You know what I mean? It was kind of just like a few parts thrown together.
Yeah.
But it was like hardly a real song. And then when we went to go do our major label debut, Siren Song on the Counterculture with Garth Richardson to be released on DreamWorks, both Garth and our A&R guy, Ron, had heard Swing Life Away.
Yeah.
And said, this is a great song. And we're like, oh, thanks. He's like, have you considered re-recording it and putting it on this record? And we're like, well, no, we didn't. We kind of put it out and it did its thing and that's it. You know, it didn't change our lives. It was already out there. There wasn't overnight success with the Fearless compilation for Rise Against. You know, it was just sort of like, oh, there's that. And let you guys re-record it. And so Garth Richardson listened to it. He goes, this is a cool song, but it's far too short. Like, there's something you're going to add to it. And like, I remember taking an acoustic guitar on his back porch and just kind of like writing that instrumental part in the middle of it and then going and re-recording it with Garth. And then it came out, which I think is an interesting part of Rise Against's story, is that we did two indie records, which did not like blow up our band overnight, but it certainly got us a cool following.
Yeah.
We did a major label record on DreamWorks. I think it came out on Geffen eventually, because DreamWorks folded before we even finished it. And the two songs that ostensibly launched our band into like a larger musical following were two previously released Rise Against songs. One being Give It All,
yeah,
which came out on the Rock Against Bush compilation at least a year prior, if not more.
Yeah.
And another one being Swing Life Away, which came out on the Fearless Punk Goes Acoustic. So two comp tracks were the two singles on our major label debut.
So strange.
And that's how people were essentially introduced to our band, which means a lot of things. But one of the things it meant for me, it really sold me on the power of a giant label, you know?
Right.
Because we already wrote these songs. We did our part. We put them out in the world. And our lives didn't change. And then we re-recorded them and gave them to somebody who's got an office in like 10 cities around the world. And then our lives did change.
Sure.
So, and I'm sure there's a million other factors in there that you could, you know, that you could talk about. But it really was like, wow, this is like two previously released comp tracks, like just started the story of this band.
And it happens all the time. I mean, if like The Angel was on that record, it probably would have been a huge hit too.
That's a good point too, right.
You know, because it was, and another Chicago band is Fall Out Boy. I mean, think of their first record. There's so many hits on that first record that would have been huge hits in their career if they'd come out later. There's no doubt in my mind. But it was at the time, Fueled by Ramen was a real, like a small label when that, you know, that first record came out.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all kind of like a timing thing. And, you know, you just never know.
Yeah. That stuff is so interesting. But I mean, at this point, you know, we're talking still about these days and they're always the kind of the glory days. And it is a wild story thinking about, you know, the young days. But now it's like you guys kind of keep very consistent. You guys have put out a lot of records. You had something like 4 gold records in a row, all on major labels. Your band continually grows its fan base. You're doing bigger and bigger shows all the time. I couldn't believe the last time, you know, when we hung out in Toronto, you're playing at the Shed in Toronto, and it's like, I don't know, 15,000 people there. Shout out to the Deftones too, but like,
absolutely,
it's pretty wild how you guys can just maintain this, and it seems like you guys just. Okay, when you know, every couple of years, every few years, whatever it is, we'll put out a new Rise Against record, and we're going to do it all over again. And people come out in droves, and they just love what you're doing. What's going through your head now? Is this just like, are you like, can we do this forever? Do we want to do this forever? You know what I mean? It's been a long time of this now.
It's been a long time of it. Yeah, and there's a lot of that. It's like there's a lot of like, can we do this forever? Or it's like, when will this stop happening? When will we stop showing up? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, it's consistently rewarding to see people kind of still giving a shit about our band and still coming out to these shows. And nights like that night were incredible. Rise Against we're like a weird band too, cause like there are some cities where like, we're like a legit arena band. There's some cities that will play like, we'll play your 1800 cap club, you know? And so that goes for like all around the globe too. But the fact that we've been here for now like 18 years, you know, 8 records deep, our front row has always been about 16 years old, you know, over the last 18 years. People are still getting introduced to it. Like that stuff is cool. That's the stuff that kind of keeps your band young, is when you realize like this thing that might be old to you, you know, this thing that might be like something you've been doing for a long time is, you know, we just played Niagara Falls last night and it's like, it's brand new to everybody in that front row. It's brand new to the 20 or so kids I met after the show by the bus, like that were like, I just heard your song for the first time last week, you know, right. And now I'm at your show and now I'm getting into your stuff. It's like, holy shit. Like there's a whole catalog of records that you might like and you might get into. I don't know what to attribute that success to. But like a lot of it, I think is that, there's an audience hungry for the things that Rise Against sings about. You know, there's an audience that's out there that looks for music that is talking about what's happening in the world, that is asking questions, you know. And I feel like that's something that's even beyond our control, is that the world is creating this appetite that music fans want. And then if most of the stuff you hear on the radio is not asking hard questions, is kind of like, if anything, just ignoring the questions, it makes us even more of an anomaly, you know? And I think that there's a niche audience for that kind of anomaly.
There is, but it also kind of blows my mind too, because when I see Anti-Flag, okay, play a Warped Tour on the side stage, and I love Anti-Flag so much, and they're saying all these things, and they're very pointed about what they're talking about, you know how the band is. And there's like 400 kids there, and I feel like all 400 of those kids, for the most part, are all on the level, and they believe every single word that they're saying, or they agree with it.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to say, when I'm at a Rise Against show, and we're in like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a southern city where you guys are still a big band, because I know some of this, like, you guys are huge in like Denver and you're huge in California and you're huge in Chicago, but there might be some pockets, you know, in the south where you're not as big. But like, let's say Texas, for example, I'm sure you guys do well there. You gotta know when you step out there, probably half the crowd doesn't agree with what your politics even are saying.
Oh yeah.
So how do you deal with that? Like, is that weird for you? Is it, does it make you more vocal? Does it make you less vocal? Does it, like, how does it change your perception of yourself and how you perform?
Well, that's a great question. And you're right. You know, it's going out there and realizing that, like, you know, there are a lot of people in this audience that wouldn't really even like me if we met in a bar, you know?
So like, you don't hang out in a lot of bars, to be honest.
That's true too. You know me too well, Shane. But if you met me, we wouldn't even meet then.
If you ran into it like a Whole Foods or something.
yeah. So that was something that Rise Against had to confront as our band was signed to a major, getting introduced to this whole more mainstream crowd of people who are also coming to our shows, getting played on the radio. So people who are not necessarily diehard like Fat Wreck fans or like Rise Against really coming to our shows, but there was all of a sudden people who just knew one song or two songs, you know?
Yeah.
Which was especially awkward if the one song they knew was Swing Life Away and they came to see our band.
Sure, they got, of course. Like,
they got like a little bit of a different side of us. And at first it was like frustrating and it felt weird, you know, like, felt like, do we belong here? Like, I don't even recognize this audience anymore. I was also a kid who grew up going to see Rage Against the Machine. I saw Nirvana play back in the day too. And I was aware of that, like, this audience around me are people that beat me up in high school. You know what I mean? And, but they love Kurt Cobain and they love Zach De La Roca. And like, how do you square those things? You know? But I think one of the things that helped me kind of navigate that was realizing that, sometimes the critique that you get as a band like Rise Against or a band like Anti-Flag really is you always get the seen to the converted critique, you know?
Yeah.
Like you're out there and, oh, you guys are just kind of like, everyone here is kind of an echo chamber and you're just reinforcing what people already believe and you're preaching to the converted of how much are you really doing? Which I think can be a valid critique. And when all of a sudden you started pouring in fans who did not agree with what we were saying, who were at odds with what we were saying, all of a sudden that critique went out the window. It's like,
of course.
Yeah. Like now this is the antidote to that critique.
Yes.
Is let's bring in people from the outside world who have never had their choice of entertainment on a Friday night start talking about the war in Iraq or like gay rights or like racism, inequality, or have like in between stage banter that might make them uncomfortable, you know, instead of like, is everybody getting high tonight? You know, like it was like, yeah, this, people were visibly uncomfortable with our shows, you know, and there were times where, especially at the height of like the war in Iraq too, where it was anti-war sentiment would eventually gather momentum. But at the beginning of the war, it was not a popular thing to say, even in a punk show.
Yeah.
And you were immediately the sort of like, this like unpatriotic, you must hate the troops kind of like, you know, demon. And we, you know, people would threaten to beat us up in the back alley after the shows. And so therein like lies the challenge. And it kind of made Rise Against a lot more fun. Because instead of preaching to the converted, we were now putting water where the fire was.
Right.
We were going to these radio shows. We were going to these places where we had our core fans, but we had a lot of people who were not used to hearing this. And that, I enjoy that challenge. You know, there's something in my DNA that likes being a thorn in someone's side. I don't know what it is. You know what I mean? Especially if that someone is like the establishment, you know?
Sure.
There's something in my DNA that I feel a responsibility not to make this place a completely safe, comfortable place, but to be a place where you walk away maybe thinking about what I said or mad about what I said, you know?
Right.
And so giving me that audience was just kind of like renewing the Rise Against. It was like, I found whole new reasons to be in this band all because the radio had brought me a new audience. And it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And if you go back to those days, and you didn't even say this when you were considering signing to DreamWorks, but bringing your message to a bigger audience at that point, you know, I mean, that had to be a factor too.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the way I saw it. I saw it as, like, the label was just simply a bigger megaphone. It was just like, how can we, let's get this stuff to where it belongs. You know, I love playing in songs in the punk and hardcore scene. I think that there's people call it preaching and converted, but I think there's like a place to be, have that message reinforced. Like a show can be like a rally cry, a place where people come together for support and sanctuary. You know, I don't see anything wrong with preaching and converted.
Absolutely.
But the label, you know, having becoming a band that people would just kind of come out to see us casually, that made everything even more exciting and more fun to me.
Hell yeah, man. I love this. I love this talk. This is great. A couple more things.
Yeah.
This is the Lead Singer Syndrome podcast, so we do talk about our voices sometimes.
All right.
I don't know if you hear it in my voice, I have like some kind of cold and I'm just starting this tour and it's the worst. And I remember when I saw you in Toronto, you were talking about how, you know, you're kind of hard on yourself. You know, you're kind of your own worst critic about your singing. And I got to say, you're one of the best, I think, in terms of a guy that sings and screams, I think you're one of the best. How's that been for you over the last, you know, better part of a 15-year career?
It's been crazy and a bizarre and probably a really boring story to anybody.
Well, we have a lot of nerds that listen to this show. You'd be surprised.
All right, good. but it's like, it's a changing thing, as I'm sure you know. You know what I mean? Like, I've never really had like a proper vocal lesson or proper vocal coaching. Certainly when I was doing it, I was younger. Like the only way I really learned how to sing when I was young was that I'd play in a room with my friends, and everybody had enough money for their own instrument, right? You could get yourself your guitar player bought a guitar, and they bought an amp. Your drummer had like a cool hand-me-down set. Your bass player had a rig that he stole from the church down the street, you know. Sure. And then like, but nobody ever had money for a PA.
No,
you know what I mean?
No.
Like, what an insanely boring way to spend money, you know? And then nobody wanted to be responsible for having a PA. So like, chances are, what you sang out of was your guitar player's first amp, you know?
Yep. Or another church down the street bass amp you stole.
Exactly. And so, you know, and lo and behold, it was not loud enough, you know?
Never.
And so when playing with friends, it was like, if you want to be heard over the drums and over the guitar and the bass, you just had to sing loud. You just had to be really, really fucking loud. And that was kind of the only thing that I think that informed my singing. And then my voice has just kind of changed over the years. It's such a strange thing. Like, I would love to know more about it one day. But just hearing my voice from like old records to hearing it today, even just singing the same songs, you know, like I'll play Cleveland tomorrow and I'll sing songs that I wrote when I was 23 years old, you know, and I can feel the way that feels different. But it is like your voice is kind of an extension of your own health, I think, you know, and
yeah,
you have to be healthy in order to do it. You can't just slack off and like be an unhealthy person. Cause I think like it'll all kind of trickle down or trickle up to like your voice. So I just try to stay healthy. I do a lot of like warm ups and cool downs and that kind of thing. I never think I'm good enough, you know, on no, stage. Cool. I never think that I play a good enough show on stage. I always wish it was, better, but like when it's all working, it's all firing all pistons. There's like, there's nothing better than that.
Right. Right. There's always that guy though in that band that like is a total piece of shit, stays up all night, drinks,
yes,
smokes cigarettes, does whatever he wants, and he's perfect every night. And you're like,
absolutely,
bastards.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And I'll be honest, like I ask these same questions that you're asking me to other singers too, and it's always like the greatest singers who have the vaguest answers. You know what I mean? That are just kind of like,
not Vic from Pierce the Veil. Have you talked to him? He warms up for like
an hour
before. He's a guy to talk to.
He seems like he's got a whole like routine of like things that he does. Like I'm watching him like work out in the stairwell and like he's always sipping something strange, you know.
He's incredible though. He's an incredible singer.
And that's what it takes, I think, for some like, and everyone's different too. I think there are some people, like you just said, who will go on stage after being up all night, you know, and just nail it, you know, and I'm super jealous of those people, you know, like for me, if like I can't stay up all night and do that, you know, or I have to do a good warm up before I go out there. I can't just hit it cold. You know, I gotta stay hydrated. I gotta do all those things or I'm letting the audience down. But I feel like it's my responsibility to do that too. It's like if you're gonna come see us and pay money to see it, it's my responsibility to like, you know, spend the day before my off day like kinda like chilling out and making sure that I still have a voice, you know. And at the same time I still wanna be able to live my life and have fun. You know what I mean? And like be out there and see the world and not just stay cooped up in my hotel room, like huddled around a humidifier. You know?
Of course,
so right. Like,
that's the challenge.
All back and forth. It's funny. I'll tell you these. The two singers I met that are probably like some of the biggest deal singers I met. Chris Cornell, and I've sang on stage with him a couple times for his solo set. He asked me to come out and do Spoon Man one in Australia, and then I also did Temple.
Really?
Of the dog I did Hunger Strike with him once in London. Just like random, like we had off
like you were veteran? Like you were veteran and he was
I was veteran. In fact, he had asked me, he goes, do you want to be me or do you want to be Eddie? And I'm just like, man, well, first of all, no one can be you. Like maybe like if you get Robert Plant in here, so I'll stick with the Eddie part. But that was definitely one of like the, you know, it was definitely one of like the pinnacles of just like doing this, was like being on stage with Chris Cornell and singing like a song like Hunger Strike, you know, with him was pretty amazing.
Do you keep in touch with him when obviously he passed away? Like, that must have been crushing for you.
And we would keep in touch. You know, it's actually one of like my hugest like regrets too, is, and I feel like I learned a lot in Chris's death, is that we would keep in touch, you know, emailing him and asking him advice on things. Like, last time we talked was about Martin guitars, because he always plays Martin. I just got myself a Martin. And he even, like, one of the last emails he sent to me was like, hey, if you ever want to, like, write songs together, like, let me know. And I was like, holy shit. Like, that'd be amazing. I can't believe Chris Cornell's asking me, like, let's collaborate, you know, like, that would be incredible. And I so regret not just like jumping on that like the next day and just be like, it's sort of one of those things where it's like, you realize our time here is short and there's no reason to hesitate and do those kind of things. But he was one of those guys where it's like, if I would bug him about his voice, I'd be like, hey man, what do you do? Like, what's your trick? He'd be like, oh, I don't think about it. I try not to think about it. And I'm like, ah, damn you and your perfect voice.
Terrible answer. You know?
Yeah, right? That just means you're like a god among men that has this like, these epic pipes that, you know, can't be slowed down. Because his voice was just, next level. He was like 10 singers in one. So.
That's crushing, man. Yes.
Right? Damn. I always hate those answers where it's like, oh, come on, man.
Well. Oh, man. Well, I won't take up too much of your time, and I really appreciate you doing this, and sorry for my lateness.
I can't believe you're still like awake and up.
Oh, I'm good. I sat in the airport for 5 hours.
I hate that.
Well, you know what? So we're all there, and everyone wants to go off. People get a coffee. Someone wants to get some food, whatever. But
someone's got to watch the gear.
We've got 7 carts of gear. Yeah. You know, and like, there's one point where I'm like, kind of, it's just me and like one other guy, and I'm like, well, I don't know, like, we're in an airport, like, there's sketchy people around, like, I'm watching people's backpacks, like, so I'd love to take a nap, but I feel like, what happens if I'm sleeping and someone's like, you know, something gets stolen in the airport? So I didn't get a wink of sleep, but no, I'm doing fine, man.
That's good.
But I gotta ask you while I have you on the phone. Did you know that we met your father once at a UPS store?
Oh.
Did you ever hear the story?
Tell me it again.
We were picking up like some CDs or something, like at Chicago suburbs at a UPS store. Mm-hmm. And we came in, and your dad was like, you guys are in a band. Oh, yeah. Oh, my son's in a band too. I'm like, oh, yeah. Well, like, what band? Thinking it's going to be like something we never heard of. And he's like, Tim from Rise Against. We're like, oh shit, that's crazy. Yeah, no, we were on tour with them. Like, we told him everything. He's like, he goes, wait a second, wait here, and he goes to the back and he brings out a dolly that said Silverstein on it that we'd apparently left at a show. You guys picked it up and it somehow ended up at his work. At the UPS store, and he returned it to us.
That is so amazing.
Isn't that the most incredible thing ever? We're like, oh yeah, we totally did leave that at like that last show, wherever it was, and like, I want to say like Poughkeepsie, New York, like 3 years ago.
That's hilarious. And I bet you know what happened. I bet Juan probably used it for a long time, and then it eventually like ended up at his house, and he doesn't live far from where my dad owned that UPS store, so probably just gravitated over there.
Exactly.
Which is really funny.
Like, it was covered, you know, in like the free Victory Record stickers they gave us. Like, we covered in that dolly in it, and I just thought that was such a funny little story. I had to tell you. I don't know if you.
That's great. You know, interesting trivia. That's the UPS store where Neil Hennessy from the Lawrence Arms. He worked there all through our high school lives, because I would always go over there and visit him.
Yeah,
and like, they would just be back there like watching Free Cable and stuff. And then my dad eventually bought it. And before he bought it, he would like interrogate Neil. I would like come home from school, and it'd be my dad and Neil at like the kitchen table. And my dad with like a pen and paper, like taking notes about how the business operates, you know? And I'm like, what are you guys doing? And why is my friend here? And I'm not here, you know? And so he would buy that place. And then the early days of Rise Against, like from working in bands, you tour with your band for many years before it makes any money at all. And so you're kind of like saving up money to go on tour. And the UPS stores where I would like end up with like in between to like try to get some hours in.
Yeah, sure.
Pay my rent. So that's really funny. I remember that story now. How crazy random is that?
I think you look good in those brown shorts.
I didn't have to wear brown shorts.
I know. I'm just kidding, man. Well, that's it, man. But the final thing is the song. What are we doing? What are we doing about the theme song? Are we keeping it? Are we changing it? Are we going with a new band? What do you think? Right. What's your vibe?
Oh man, I think you should go with a new band. But I don't like. Yeah, so okay. You need like.
If you
like
had
a cool,
podcast,
like,
what would you what like? What would really get you in the zone? Like you know, every episode.
Bed for the Scraping by Fugazi.
Okay.
I don't know if you know that one, but like, cue it up after we got the phone.
Oh, I'm queuing it up.
I think it would be a great intro.
It's funny. I'm pretty well versed in Fugazi, but I'm not very good at the
names
of the songs.
Song, you might,
I'm not very good at the names of the songs.
Totally. I'm not good at it. And they have so many weird names, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Including that one. But when you hear this one, you'll know this one.
All right, man. Well, hey, there it is. And we'll see. I better like it, man. Don't let me down.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Sorry
Tim,
if you hate it.
Dude, Tim, thanks so much. Have a great rest of the tour. And
you too.
I'll see you around.
Tell all the boys hello and have a good time out there.
I will do.
Cool.
Thanks again, man.
All right, Shane.
Yeah, cheers.
Bye.
So there it is with my friend Tim. What a great conversation. What a great dude. Thanks so much, Tim, for doing this. And of course, I know that Fugazi song, Bed for the Scraping. I know it is. I don't want to be defeated. I don't want to be defeated. I don't want to be defeated. That's how I know it. I don't want to be defeated because they got funny song titles. But hey, it looks like we got a new theme song. So thank you, Tim, for that. And hey, everybody, tune in next week. It's Halloween. I've got something very special for you. I don't want to spill the beans. Let's keep it a surprise. I promise it's going to be good. It's going to be really, really good. So make sure you're subscribed. And of course, feel free to get in touch. LeadSingerSyndrome@gmail.com. And of course, on any social media platform, we're on them all. Again, if you like the show, check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. Again, the link, LeadSingerSyndrome.com/all-access. I will leave you with the tune. So many great Rise Against tunes. So many. But I'm going to play one of my favorites from Revolutions Per Minute. And we talk a little bit in the podcast about how the songs from when they were an indie band ended up becoming big hits. And this is one that I think could have been. Here is Like the Angel by Rise Against. I'm Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. We'll see you next week.